I, as chair of the board, call this meeting to order. Will those who are present identify themselves? I'm Bob.
Ellie's here.
I'm here too, Tealita.
Tim Ogden, interim secretary of the board, recording the attendance.
Okay, that's everyone is here. Lucy is not able to join us for the time being. She had a personal issue come up and maybe join us later. And Greg is on his way. But for now, we're just kind of informally discussing the attachments that we set out and having people have comments on the choice of each car.
Can you, I don't know if we want to wait on this, but like, I guess my biggest question is on related to KIPP.
Uh-huh.
Like, what do they do other than identify great principles?
Well,
Greg, by the way, just walked into the room. Say hello to Greg.
Hello, guys. Sorry.
Hi, Greg. Greg, did you read the attachments or did you read the highlight portions?
I read the highlighted portions.
Okay.
I don't know that I saw everything. I just saw the meeting the ones from you. Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, the ones that I sent last night.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
So let's just dig in.
Well, let's start. Can we start with clause 3, the first one?
Yes, let's start with clause 3.
Okay. So on clause 3,
please
I feel pretty strongly about the recommendation. When we last met, we hadn't even looked at nurse family partnerships. They weren't an applicant, and we kind of, you know, we didn't know what to do at that point, and then we found out about them and sent them an app, and I did a site visit today. And I really, I mean, it's interesting. I think that they are definitely, in my mind, like certainly the most extreme case of sort of a lot of the principles that we believe in being carried out, like very, very thoroughly. And so they're, you know, they're a very good fit with what we, you know, at least what I believe, you know, my picture of a great nonprofit would look like. And I think the general things we discussed for that would be that they're, you know, they've performed very, very methodologically strong studies of their program. They did so before really scaling it up. The studies are encouraging, but they're really written in a way that just puts it all out there. They're public, they're academic, you know, they're published. And then they are devoted to taking this model that, you know, while I don't think the empirical evidence is overwhelming, I think it's encouraging that it is making some kind of difference, positive difference in people's lives later in life. They're taking that model and putting a lot of effort into carrying out that model faithfully in a way that replicates what they believe to be the most essential parts of what worked in those trials. And they also, I mean, they collect an enormous amount of data. They were able to present it all easily, no problem. A lot of the kind of good qualities we talked about for PSI at the last meeting, I mean, they have those and probably more so. They have, you know, really, like their dashboard, the ability to see what's going on at their organization is really, really strong. And so when you put it all together, I mean, I think they look like an organization that is a really good fit with us. And I, you know, I feel really good about granting them. And it, the Head Start, I mean, Head Start is, like, there's certainly, when I look at all the evidence I've seen, I certainly believe in the potential of daycare to make a difference as well. And it's really hard with all the ways that people all measure different things at different times in different ways. It's hard to get any sense of how those two magnitudes compare. So I'm largely kind of breaking the tie in my head based on those comments about just the, you know, the different types of organization.
My general leaning towards the it's an incredibly difficult name to remember, the Nurse Family Partnership.
Yeah.
Is that your Head Start receives an incredible amount of attention. That's being researched by all sorts of people in all sorts of ways. I had never heard of the Nurse Family Partnership before. And, you know, obviously, logically, it makes sense. I think it has the studies here showing long-term follow-up and that there are some legitimate reasons to believe it's having an effect. I think there's something to be said by making our grantee a program that does have some evidence for it and is not nearly as in the public eye as Head Start is.
So does anyone disagree with the suggestion here to award the grant to that organization?
To the Nurse Family Partnership? No, I think Tim's comments are very pertinent to it, Holden, and particularly as they're sort of not so well known. I agree. I think that's a good fit in terms of where you're putting the research effort to find something that not everybody is researching and cutting and slicing and dicing 100 different ways.
I mean, I think the reason why I'm part of about Nurse Family Partnership is not necessarily because people know it or don't know it. That I don't know, weighs relatively minimally in my mind, and much more that I think I feel good about it. Like, I think that they're a better organization, you know, the way that they run their organization along with what they're delivering than the Head Start programs. And so I'm in favor of it. Because I think it's the winner. It's the clear winner.
Yeah, I want to put out there that I do think people having heard of it or not heard of it, to me, is not, I mean, it's not a very, to me, it's a bit of a side point, because the real question is whether or not it's popular. Is there room to expand it? Are there more people who need it? And I think in both cases, I'm not sure, but I think in both cases there is room. So I just wanted to put that out there, but it doesn't sound like we disagree on the action to be taken. Unless Greg does.
I agree with the action. I have questions, but I'd rather, because they're superfluous to the decision, just if we have time at the end, about certain things about the cause and whether the cause is worthwhile, and like a chain of questions is essentially how helpful you think this is, but I would agree with the decision. So I don't want to hold things up for that chain of questioning.
Yeah, I think your question is much harder, Greg. I agree. Let's make the decision first. It sounds like we're unanimous. Is that right?
Yeah.
Holden, I have a quick question about where the Nurse Family Partnership programs are actually operating, and I think it would be extremely helpful if we can easily provide that information, because I can see people who are looking at the site not only being interested in the overall organization, but in saying, okay, well, the overall organization is doing the infrastructure work. I'd also like to support the actual delivery of services under this program.
Give to a site. That's on their website. They have a map. You can like click a state and get the contact info for all the sites at the state. And, it's sitting right. I mean, so much of what we know about them is sitting right there, and then we ask them to fill in a lot of the blanks. One thing actually that is worth mentioning is that the stuff they sent to us, they have marked it all as completely for our eyes only, which I find problematic. So we are going to talk to them about that. In the past, we've generally, when we've talked about that, we've found a reasonable compromise and a way to give donors the good information and the important information. My feeling, if they're willing to send it us, they're probably willing to share it in some form. That's not ideal. On the other hand, the stuff that's on public records that anyone could get is a lot. The academic studies, most of those are available, not even having to pay anything, just full text.
I guess given that, I would not recommend against them, but I would recommend that we note some concern that if they're not, if there's beyond what we would consider reasonable, have the conversation, that they wouldn't share publicly, given that one of GiveWell's overall goals is to get more information in the public domain, is to make sure that we note that very much, that, we do have a concern here that they should be sharing more information than they are willing to.
Yeah, we're going to start with the conversation, and I agree with you. If we think that they're, if there's too much being withheld, then we'll say that. Okay. So do we need an official vote, or it sounds like we're unanimous?
Yeah, I think we're unanimous. I think we can say that we're going to grant Nurse Family Partnership. And Holden, you'll let them know.
Okay. So So moving on to, can I move on to Class 4?
Yes.
Give a quick, you know, little intro. I mean, Class 4, I think, is, they're very different. There's three organizations doing very different things. They're very different models. In my mind, if you went with a just empirical evidence approach, it's a little tricky because KIPP has got the least sort of methodologically strong stuff available, but still, even with that, I think that the, you know, just the, if you're only looking for, you know, who's making kids score higher on tests, I think KIPP probably has the strongest case. But then also, there is another, there's also this organization thing going on again, where we just, we feel that the vision of the organization is really clear, really strong, really consistent, and the model makes a lot of sense to us. And, you know, I think that we've talked to sort of people in the field, people in academia, they've, you know, they and especially their people have a really good reputation. And so not to take anything necessarily away from the other ones, but KIPP did stand out in that aspect for me. And so that's another part of what's going on here, especially with education where the funding is so complex. You know, there's a lot of public and private partnerships and such like that. I think that rather than hyper-focusing too much on the model, I think it's good to say, you know, they are doing something that makes a lot of sense. They're doing everything you'd want to do to monitor it and continue learning from it. It seems to be going well. And from there, you kind of, to me, in my mind, I make kind of a judgment about the quality of the organization and say, well, you know, probably needs are going to change, and we don't know exactly what the best use of money is going to be, but they're, you know, I feel good about what they're going to do with it. So that's how I think that they, I feel relatively strongly about granting them as well. Anyone support another candidate? Questions?
I mean, my question, I'd just like to get a more tangible sense of what is unique about KIPP. Like, you say things like basically they, you know, the essentials of their value added are finding good principals and basically having good administrators of schools and keeping those schools open longer. Like, is that it? Like, is that, that's the core of it, that they're better at picking administrators than other people?
I mean, it's the core of what they do, and then it obviously leads to better results. Like, you'd expect that it would lead to better results. So they pick people who they think are going to make great principals, and then those principals go out and are trying to pick great teachers. And then together that creates an environment of talented people, talented, passionate people teaching in schools. And then in addition, the schools are open longer, which, you know, you'd expect would help the students learn more. And the KIPP organization tries to relieve the teachers and especially the principals of the administrative work so they can focus on education.
Let me just speak to, in a sense, Bob, it's not a unique model. It's something that a lot of organizations try to do. Okay, we try to find, you know, good principals and have good people in schools and run charter schools. And just, you know, reasons, but it's all execution, because if you really do have good people running the schools well, then it's not a problem to me that it's simple. And so the reasons that we think that, you know, it's not, we think it's a good model, it makes sense if it's carried out well, and the reasons I think that it is being carried out well are a combination of A, they have a level of, well, they have size and, you know, scale to an extent that no other similar organization we know of has. That's, you know, partly a good sign that they've been able to get both the state and private support, and also a good sign for the ability to scale and repeat over and over. And then that becomes much more impressive when you start looking at the empirical case. It just seems pretty consistent the way that the, you know, our guess that we've written up is that there's a pretty significant positive impact on children's learning as measured by test scores. So that is something that we haven't seen from any other organization. We've got a lot of schools, and we've got a pretty consistent effect that although we haven't We don't have a perfect methodological way of looking at it. We're certainly, you know, controlling for as much as we can and guessing that it is real and not sort of a bias artifact. So you got that. And then they also do have an excellent reputation. Again, the size thing, I'm guessing that they probably do to some extent have their first, pick of the people. When we visited a school, and it was very, it was only one school, and it could have been, their best school, but still, for the profile and for the area, the whole thing, like all the doors were open, you could walk into any classroom. It was definitely beyond just having kind of, one orderly classroom or something like that. There was a lot of order, people were like definitely, they were well behaved, and the basic impression we got is that they're putting together kids who in some sense are ready to learn, and there's a lot of debate over just how how much different those kids are from the kids as a whole, but at least who are, families would rather send them to a good school, and then they're taking teachers who are pretty serious about getting the job done, and so you just got a lot of people, who all want to focus, and just in terms of order and focus and concentration and discipline, it was strong on, it seemed strong on those. So those are a bunch of the things that we think about KIPP.
So how does that whole, so I looked at the tables, and I'm sharing them right now, and so maybe didn't read it carefully enough to understand. So were you able, did you control for that thing, the parental thing that you're talking about, or you're not able to control for
that?
Well,
we can't, there's no perfect way to do it, but we went beyond what you're normally able to do. And so, Ellie, you can describe exactly what we did. The basic idea was that we took, schools in the same districts and found that, on a change basis, that A, a lot of the times the kids are starting at similar levels when they enter KIPP, and B, that, just the change is much greater for the kids who enter KIPP in fifth grade. And then we did other things to try and control for, whether that's being caused by selective attrition, i.e. weaker students leaving the school, causing test scores to artificially go up. We do believe there's some of that happening, but we're still guessing that there's an effect. So it's definitely a bunch of guesswork. It is very far from being an experimental design study, which would really answer that question. And, one of the things we've been trying to hunt down over the last few days is that we remember hearing from someone, I think one of the academics, that they are working on an experimental design study, a longitudinal where they follow all the kids, those who are in and those who are out. And we're not able to completely confirm that, but that's, I think definitely that's one of the issues, is that in a way we know less about them than the Children's Scholarship Fund, because the studies of vouchers are very rigorous. This could still be a problem with the methodology, but we've done the best we can, and we're guessing that it is not all just the parents and the kids' motivation. We're guessing that doesn't explain the whole effect.
John, do you have in here, I missed, how did you try to deal with the attrition?
We tried to deal with the attrition with the information we have about the number of kids who normally leave the schools. And the difference in performance levels between the kids who leave and the kids who stay. And then there's also the corollary to the attrition problem, which is the addition problem, that often kids who leave are replaced by other kids. And so then we used what little information we had about how much better the kids who arrive are than those who leave to do some estimate of whether or not the effect stays. What we found is that, we took a pretty harsh estimate that, attrition is pretty consistent, even across the schools where the class size doesn't change from year to year. We assume that kids are leaving and kids are arriving, and kids who are leaving are worse and kids who are arriving are better. And even then, you have to assume pretty harsh things that, we think are pushing the levels of reasonability to assume that KIPP students aren't improving their test scores upon arrival.
Right. You see, the way that they approach that is through basically like a scenario analysis, right?
Yeah.
We have to make these assumptions.
We had two papers looking at two different schools that did control for, like, nearly, you know, that pretty much did control for this whole thing. In fact, I think the one for Jima was, I mean, I guess exactly what you would want, because it tracked all the kids who entered KIPP, including the ones that left. I don't know. I don't think it tracked the ones who were rejected from the lottery, which is, I guess, like, the final step you'd want to get a true experimental design. But we had two studies that were, you know, that were really tracking all the kids, so they didn't have attrition problems, and they were able to document that same effect, certainly smaller than it appears, without correcting, but still there and still very significant. And then we did our scenario analysis where we said, what would you have to think about attrition? How many kids are leaving? How much worse are their scores than the rest of the students to explain away the whole effect? And we looked at what you'd have to think that KIPP is having no effect. And, you know, it was very far from the numbers in those other papers, and that's all. So that's pretty far from perfect, but that's our...
Okay.
And it's worth it. This is not an easy call in my mind at all, because the other two organizations also have very compelling models that make a lot of sense to me. And there's, you know, if you, especially once you stop hyper-focusing on test scores, because I think test scores is particularly, I think there's, you know, there's going to be a lot of just ability in there, too. You know, the Children's Scholarship Fund makes an argument that they're improving, that kids have better character because they're going to better schools, and that it's not just coming out in their test scores, which are going to be, you know, so connected to IQ. And so they have some evidence for that we frankly find a bit shaky. But, you know, that's worth considering. I think all three are models that make a lot of sense, models that are being done over and over and over, replicated across the country. We have reason to believe they're being replicated pretty consistently and faithfully. And they're all, you know, they've all got an interest in studying, and they've all got some evidence. They've all got pretty strong evidence about how things are going. You know, but if you are looking, especially if you're looking for kind of a strong effect on test scores, we would bet, even with the methodological problems, we would still bet that KIPP is coming out the strongest there. We're certainly hoping that that KIPP is going to, you know, that there's going to be experimental studies of them in the future.
My question is about the replicability of the KIPP model in such a way as to have an actual impact on the broader issue.
Mm-hmm.
So the model is you get the best principals and the best teachers in the KIPP schools. That presumably serves the people in this KIPP schools, but potentially makes things worse for everybody else.
Yeah, I think that is a concern. And the kind of model that I have in my head is just that I would guess, and I think it makes a lot of sense to me, that when you put all the good, you know, all the sort of serious teachers in one school, you get an effect far beyond kind of the sum of their abilities, because it's a consistency thing and a discipline thing, and it's, you know, it's being able to have a school that runs in an orderly way with consistently high expectations, I think would be, you know, I think that having good teachers scattered throughout bad schools, it's, you know, when you add up the impact of each of those good teachers, I think it would be less than if you put them all together in one school, especially if you put them together in that school that is particularly structured to let them do their job. And so, you know, that's a big part of the KIPP model is the, it's both autonomy and support for the school, because they have one team that's kind of taking care of a lot of the administrative work that is traditionally done by the principal, and that's freeing up the principal, and then they, you know, they're able to do their thing. So the school we visited, I mean, they have, it's certainly not, you know, the schools have a lot, an individual school will have a heck of a lot more to its strategy and to its model than what we've described. We've just given the abstract, you know, from the top control structure. And in an individual school, I mean, they're doing things like, you know, they're putting college banners all over the classroom to create a, you know, constant attention to the idea of college. I mean, I have no idea if that's a good idea, but the point is that you've got these people with, you know, the ability to kind of create a consistent and autonomous environment.
To what extent are these guys basically testing internally, like you give the example, I don't know, putting college banners up all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
Are they thinking about, are they testing what they're doing, testing their methodology?
Well, I don't think, they are definitely, they definitely say to us, and we believe it because of the kind of availability of that data, that they are, constantly definitely reviewing the test scores and talking about what they can be doing better, and also not just the test scores, but behavior of children and such like. I think it is, as far as college matters, I mean, I think when you're running a school, you have to do a lot of guessing and use a lot of intuition. I mean, we can, to study something in any really rigorous way that deals with all the concerns that we always talk about, I mean, it's an enormously extensive operation. It takes a long time. There's almost always, a lot of messiness and a lot of issues. So I'm not sure exactly what you mean. Like, I think for little tweaks, for things like what attitudes the teachers take in and what rules they have in school and what they put in the classrooms, I don't think you can reasonably run these highly rigorous studies of those. I think those are going to be largely, you got to kind of try them and see how the kids respond and go with your gut. But then the larger, the whole package that, whether going with your gut and whether observing the kids, whether that iterative process is ultimately having good results, that is the kind of thing that you can test in a more rigorous way. Does that make sense?
So, Holden.
Yep.
I was going to move off, Kip, to the question I had on the Children's Scholarship Fund, but I don't want to take.
Well, I think we're trying to make a decision, so I don't think we need to discuss one organization at a time.
Okay, so my question, I haven't wrapped my head around, how to understand the stuff on the Children's Scholarship Fund, so it seems so shocking to me that vouchers wouldn't create improvements in test performance, so I just want to understand what's being controlled for. In that, that literally you put them into the better, I would assume that vouchers have the tendency of taking kids out of schools with lower test scores and putting them into schools with higher test scores, and yet they don't affect the people at all, it doesn't matter what school you're in? Is that how to read that result?
Well, partly. I think it's very important to realize that they're looking at the studies that look at students there's a trick here, because a lot of the students who win the lottery end up not attending the school anyway, and I think a lot of the kids who lose the lottery end up attending the school. And part of the issue is we don't have a good sense, and we asked the executive director and got an answer that certainly didn't satisfy us of how those scholarship sizes are being set. And so, there's a real question of what is the, is it true that a scholarship is how often is that causing a kid who wouldn't have attended school to attend the school? So the numbers we have on that are generally, they are making a difference. More kids attend the school. But it's certainly not that, each kid who gets a scholarship is a kid who wouldn't have and then did. So that's one important thing to keep in mind. And then usually when they look at kids, so then you have two ways when you do an experimental study. You have two approaches of looking at what's going on. You can look at kids who attended and kids who didn't. And when you do that, they always, they find effects on test scores. And the problem with that, obviously, is that you've got a huge selection bias in there, in my mind, because you're looking at the people who went through with it and decided to pay for it versus the people who didn't go through with it and decided not to pay for it, and the families. And, and I believe the family has a huge impact. And then you've got the other approach, which is the intention to treat approach, where you just compare lottery winners to lottery losers. So you're going to have a lot of people who won the lottery and didn't follow through, and that's going to dilute the effect and make it harder to show statistical significance, and there's not really a lot you can do about that. And when they do that, they're not finding these effects, except in the subpopulations and the classifications are disputed, and et cetera. So it's a tricky issue. I think it's hard to believe, although it is, frankly, it's somewhat easier for me to believe than it used to be because of what I've read about the achievement gap and where it's opening. I think that, the basic argument that I think a KIPP would make is that by the time these kids enter school, they are way behind. They need a remedial school, not a decent school, a remedial school, a school that's targeted at their needs and that's specially built to help them get what they need. And, the KIPP people are saying this based on partly on their observations of the students, because it's also important to keep in mind that the KIPP people are in the schools and watching the schools. Children's Scholarship Fund is giving these scholarships and is very hands-off, And so, you know, the KIPP people, I think, are observing these students a lot more closely. They're saying that. And also, the empirical evidence is, I believe, pretty unambiguous on that point, that yes, there is a enormous achievement gap by the time the kids are entering kindergarten, and it's about the size that it is throughout school. And so, you know, I pretty much, through some combination of the, you know, there's the question of how much impact does a scholarship have on whether you attend the school, and then there's the question of, do these kids need to get out of a bad school, or do they need to get into a special school that is really targeted at, you know, at treating them as though they need extra help and giving it to them?
So just listening to you speak, Holden, it doesn't sound as though there's too much evidence backing the children's scholarship funding in terms of any type of evidence, and I'm just interested why children that do get a scholarship don't go, and those that don't do. So it just sounds sort of very unclear as to where the benefits are.
Well, I think it's pretty clear to me why children who don't do. I mean, if you're sending your kid to Catholic school and you have a very low income, but you're determined to send them, why wouldn't you apply for a scholarship? And then you would lose the scholarship, and you would, you know, a lot of parents will send their kids anyway. And especially, like,
but
it's
I'm
that question, how carefully calibrated are those scholarship sizes? It's very possible that, you know, that you have parents who are ready to send their kids, and they're applying for the scholarship anyway. On the other end, it's a little more confusing, but it's still not, I mean, the school application process and commitment, that's a much bigger commitment than applying for a scholarship. The scholarship's kind of the first step, so I find it pretty believable.
But basically, there's the tuition they have to pay is more than the cost of the scholarship. And
yeah,
you can imagine someone signing up for a scholarship and then still having to pay, you know, $1,500 to go to a private school, and that's just being too expensive when it actually, when push comes to shove.
Right. None of these scholarships are full scholarships.
Okay.
And that's another thing that's going to explain a lot of it, you know, could explain, and a lot of this is, you know, we don't really know, but it could explain a lot of that difference, if you believe there's a difference, that the Children's Scholarship Fund, ultimately, you know, anyone who takes advantage of their service in a family that is already pretty, in my opinion, they know what school they want to go to, they know they want to send their kid to school, and even though they have a low income, they're always putting some in. They're always paying a good amount of money to send their kid to school. So it's also a question of what kids you can help. It's a question of whether, you know, whether there are just different populations that are more sensitive to different treatments. And I would bet that the KIPP kids are different from the CSF kids. CSF kids have families that are paying and that are picking out the school. And the KIPP kids, I mean, yeah, you have to apply to KIPP, but it's through the standard lottery system, and to me it's a much lower bar.
My general feeling is that none of these programs are clearly better than the other enough to warrant awarding the full grant to one of them and naming one of them the winner. It even occurs to me that there is a protest vote here that says, let's make the money available to anybody who is doing the kind of research that we think needs to be done on the impact of the quality of the overall school as opposed to any of these other things that people are studying. I'm thinking, of course, of the most recent blog post, but if nobody is looking at these things that seem to be the leverage points for the majority of in small donors. My concern about KIPP is that it may solve the problem for a very small number of people, but that doesn't actually solve the problem. I can see Teach for America because of just improving teachers in schools, but recognize the point of just putting one good teacher in a whole bunch of lousy schools is unlikely to have a huge impact.
Yeah, it's important. We put this in the attachment. You should recognize with Teach for America that the, you know, that is a general, there's more advantages to that than just the teacher gets in and the students do better. Because KIPP and a lot of those similar organizations, they're using a lot of Teach for America teachers. That's a lot where they're getting their teachers. And so, that, you know, there may be more variance in that pool of teachers, and so the high end may be better. And when you concentrate them, that makes things like HIP possible. And then also, you know, they're also trying to build, Teach for America is trying to pull intelligent people into education, get them interested in education, and have them, you know, that's kind of a, they want to get more bright people interested in these issues and wanting to work on them for their life.
Like I said, my general feeling is that this is an issue that a lot of people care about, and there are wars, quote-unquote, being fought over what's the best way to do something about American education. And as I've read the stuff as you guys have went along, the conversations that we've had on various things, ultimately my conclusion is that there's very little evidence that that there's information out there to lead to the kind of change that needs to happen. Because the agendas driving the research are either ideological, they've already decided what the answer is, and they fund research to prove that what they've already decided works, or it looks at things that are irrelevant to what individual donors can do.
I think there's it's a concern, but all three of these organizations, there are studies of what you'd want to know if you want to donate there. And so certainly that blog post that drafted was expressing frustration that there isn't more research relevant to donating in general, and especially about kind of what works in education instead of these big political battles over charters versus vouchers versus public. But, you know, for any of these three, I mean, I can tell you exactly how they studied what they do. Teach for America did a very rigorous, very clean study of their teachers and how their teachers' kids perform compared to other teachers. I mean, that's what you want to know. Children's Scholarship Fund, I found the papers on vouchers frustrating because they're focusing on, you know, voucher versus non-voucher, but if you're thinking of donating to Children's Scholarship Fund, that's exactly what you want to know, because Children's Scholarship Fund is very hands-off, and they are literally just a voucher program. You know, they are giving the money and hoping that it goes from there, certainly not, you know, any more specific than those papers are. And then KIPP, you know, there's papers looking at KIPP schools and looking at the kids in the same districts and following them around, and then we pulled a whole bunch of data that, you know, certainly there's no publication bias in there because we pulled everything we could find and looked at that.
The argument they're holding is that none of those things really address how to fix the overall problem.
Tim, what do you mean?
But,
Tim, I'm a little, you just keep saying, you said fix the overall problem. And that's something that I'm just not sure I understand what you mean. Because when I think about donating to KIPP, I think about helping a select group of people that are able to enroll in that school. And the more schools KIPP can open, the more people they can help. The more, you know, vouchers CSF gives, the more people they can help. And I'm not as focused on what will fix the achievement gap for the whole country. The same way I'm concerned about providing a net to a person in Africa to help save their life from malaria, as opposed to, you know, eradicating malaria across the entire continent.
There are a couple of things there. One is, when I talk about fixing the problem on a broad scale, it's not fixing the problem for absolutely everybody, but I find it hard to believe that the KIPP model is broadly replicable to enough places in enough ways to help a broad enough segment of the population without making the problem worse for everybody else. Right. Even if you were able to put a KIPP school in every city in America, which I don't think can be done under that model, even if you were to do that, then, again, what you're doing is you're sucking more and more good teachers out of all of the other schools and putting them in one place so that they're helping a limited number of people.
That may be an exaggeration.
The Children's Scholarship Fund issue on this voucher, non-voucher issue, you know, the big frustration is it's not, for me, about voucher versus non-voucher. It's a question of, you know, scaling up vouchers only makes sense if we know what the characteristics of the good schools are to get the kids into those schools. Distributing vouchers and comparing vouchers to non-vouchers, in my mind, is completely irrelevant until we know what are the characteristics of the schools where we should be trying to get the kids into versus out of, because that then provides a replicable model for fixing the schools that we're getting them out of instead of just taking kids out of them. And in that sense, I see Teach for America as potentially being the one that is most broadly replicable in a way that helps a broad enough group of people to actually have an impact. you know, the comparison to BedNets is you get someone a BedNet and they are going to use it. We know that person's going to not get malaria, and that's a replicable model. We can focus on getting BedNets to more and more people. It's not clear to me that we can focus on getting vouchers to more and more kids without knowing which schools we're supposed to be getting them into, or starting up these special schools with all the best and brightest teachers in as many places as possible without doing harm.
Well, I've got a couple of responses to that. First off, I think it is people do try somewhat to study what works in education, but I think it's very hard to in any rigorous way. Sorry, there was a noise in my phone. Am I still on?
Yes, you're on.
Okay. It's very hard to, in a rigorous way, say, you know, well, it's class size or it's this or it's that, especially because I do believe that the quality of just the principals and the teachers is going to be an ineliminable element of that. Wow, this thing's still going. I think I may be running out of battery. So, Ellie, if I get disconnected, just call myself. But anyhow, I think it is, you know, I think it's a very, like, that's a very far-off goal, and that's something that everyone wants to do and everyone wants to work on, is figure out what are the qualities that we need. But at this point, we're more sort of asking, like, who can, well, I mean, you've got different models, and you've got different possible models, because you could take the voucher model and just say, look, I don't know exactly what the differences are, but I'm willing to bet that a school with tuition, a private school, a school that the parents choose over another school is going to be more orderly, is going to have, you know, going to be missing a lot of the basic problems, just like huge discipline problems, totally unmotivated staff, et cetera. That's your bet with Children's Scholarship Fund. And then with KIPP, I think that they are, you know, they're trying to figure out what works for these kids, but a lot of that just has to be done in a highly contextualized, individual way with individual groups of kids. And so I don't know that waiting for sort of this top-down, we'll design a school like this and it'll work is the answer. I think it's better in my mind. Like, if you believe that KIPP has good people who are successfully looking at kids, understanding the kids, and helping the kids, then just give those people more and more money and let them decide what to do with it. And as long as they can expand the schools, they will. And when they're not able to do that anymore, they'll do something else. But the point is, they're working with these kids. They're on the ground. They're, you know, they're thinking about how to help them. And if they're getting it done, then hopefully good things will come of that. So the final point I want to make is that on Teach for America, Ellie and I did have this conversation, because there is still something more zero-sum about KIPP and even CSF when you look within the cause. There's certainly a feeling that, you know, Teach for America is kind of making the pie bigger in some sense, while the other two are, you know, have this very limited room to grow. But then when you look, like Ellie and I aren't, when you ask about this cause and its validity relative to other causes, I mean, I'm not totally convinced that what we want is to pull more and more talented people into education. There's a lot of things that talented people could be doing. And one of my biggest problems with this cause, I mean, this was my favorite cause a year ago. This is where I used to give all the time. And I'm realizing that there's not really a lot of understanding of what kids need to learn and why they need to learn it and what, you know, how important K-12 education really is. I honestly don't believe that's well understood at all. And so I'm not sure how I feel about pulling more and more talented people into K-12 education. I'm honestly not sure how I feel about that. And there's a lot of things for talented people to do. And I think global poverty is a huge issue. And when you have, you know, I think that it's not such a terrible thing for people to do things that help global growth. I'm not 100% sure that's worse than pulling them into education.
Tim, it seems to me that what we're trying to do here is make the most impact we can, and like that's like, I don't know, my view of it is like quantity of impact. That's not like breadth of impact. And it seems to me like if I can get a lot of impact by giving my money to a KIPP school, that seems much more valuable than like happening to get a very small impact across a whole, maybe a small impact across a whole bunch of different people through the Teach for America experience. And so, you know, anyway, I think that we should keep in our mind, like, what is going to make the largest positive impact, not to the most number of people, but, like, in whatever absolute terms, the largest positive impact. And I think that that's KIPP.
Yeah, and I agree with that, and I have sympathy for the pulling the good principles out, but I think that Holden's argument on that is pretty good, and I believe that that's probably true, which is that that it's better to get the good principles in one place, the good people in one place, and scattering them all over the place won't have that much impact.
It seems like the same thing you do with a university. You bring in, you get. Like, you could say, oh, why does, University of Michigan shouldn't exist because it attracts all the best talent, right? And then, then Central and whatever, Western and whatever, all those other schools would be better if that talent was distributed. But, it seems clear in that setting that there's a multiplier effect of talent coming together, and I don't see why it wouldn't be true in this setting.
And the results of that, given, I can't even believe, I didn't expect the voucher argument to be as clear as it is. I would have thought that results would be so shockingly good, because you would think it's not, you don't have to know what's good in education, you just have to know what's terrible, and it seems like that would be,
that's what we thought too, right.
So if you just took the kids out of the schools that are just, where people are getting killed or whatever, and put them into semi-decent looking schools, that I would have believed that just by walking the hallways, I could make that determination, and that the impact would be very large, and so large that it would be hard not to measure, that just taking kids out of the really horrible schools and putting them into just mediocre schools. So that's pretty big surprising to me, but it fits. I also believe what Holden's answer on that relating to KIPP was that's very sensible, that it has to do with, it's not like you take the kid that is so far behind and put them into a normal school and they get what they need. They just get left further behind. And putting them into a school where people are going to focus on that problem, seems like a pretty sensible answer. That's the only answer I can find compelling to that question. And then, and I'm sorry to keep going, but then the other point draws on that, then when you look at the data, the numbers, actually, with given that you can't see anything in the numbers for the voucher kids, when I would have thought that it would have shown up pretty obviously, taking kids out of bad schools and putting them into just mediocre schools would have worked, and that you see, actually, if I read these numbers right that Holden produced, pretty big differences. That's, pretty surprising, even when you consider a pretty extreme stress test. When nothing else needs to work, that's pretty compelling to me. So I'm voting in favor of Holden's KIPP idea, or there I should say.
The idea
idea.
I had to start an organization called KIPP. I think I feel like we've been over most things. I feel like we're ready to vote. I mean, the one thing that I want to put out there is that the staff supports KIPP. Partly because of, there's two kind of things in the back of our heads. One is we're not sure about this cause. We're really not. I've really started to question how much, just whether this is the right place to focus to close the opportunity gap. Is closing the achievement gap? I'm not sure if that's true. And so given that, we want to find, I don't know. We're not as focused on the whole problem or on that sort of thing that Tim brought up. And then the other thing is that we get a good impression from that organization that they're, everyone is very good at explaining, everyone at KIPP is very good at explaining what they do, is very clear on the vision. They seem to be very clear on their vision and what they're doing. And so that's kind of a judgment call, and it's subjective evidence. But when you put that together with the fact that they are the only ones with that strong empirical evidence, we kind of have a, give the money to the good organization and let them do their thing kind of attitude in the back of our heads. Because when we find an organization that's pretty much everything they do seems sensible to us, and they're able to answer all our questions really well and really clearly, we can't really think, oh, they should be doing that, they should be doing that, everything seems reasonable, it's at that point where we kind of want to stop nitpicking and say, well, maybe, they probably do, they probably do have better ways to use this money than we do anyway. So let's give it to them and trust them.
All right, let's vote. I vote yes.
Yep, I'm in favor of KIPP.
I'm a Kipper.
That's three. Tim, would you want to protest? I don't know that abstaining is the right protest, but probably the one that's available to me of just.
Well, you may also submit a letter of dissent.
I could. It remains that I don't disagree that KIPP has good evidence of what they're doing and that this is a good way of impacting a very small set of students. It just seems to me that focusing on this approach is not something that's going to address the achievement gap. It's going to address the achievement gap for these the students lucky enough to end up in a KIPP program.
Yeah, well, I think we've been over
that. Not going to be very many people.
I think that's worth considering, but anyway, I still think are we done with that, or is anyone flipping?
No.
I don't think I made my point any differently than the last time.
Yeah, I don't either.
I didn't flip people the first time. I don't expect to flip them now.
I have one small thing to raise, and I don't know whether it's worth going down this road. Like, I wonder about Teach for America as being a recommended organization just at all. It seems like, you know, the scalability question, like we're being a donor replacement, you know what I mean? That they're going to have, whatever, the schools are going to ask for 2,500 teachers, they got funding for 2,500 teachers. Does it make sense for us then, like, are we actually making an impact? Are we adding another teacher necessarily? So that was one thing that concerned me about it. And the second thing that concerned me about it is, like, you know, I think that the impact, like, given the rigorousness of the study, right, and the fact that in some ways I can believe this study a lot more than I can believe KIPP, or I can believe Children's Scholarship Fund. I believe Children's Scholarship Fund, even if the data doesn't necessarily exactly come out. We got rigorous tests, and the impact is negligible. And
it's not negligible, but it's not big.
It is no impact on reading and a minor impact on math. Right, I don't know exactly what you say here.
Right, I know you're not using the right terms, but it's not big. I agree with that.
Right, and that,
I think that when you put in the way that these other charter schools rely on those teachers, you know, those specific teachers from that specific program, and you put in, you know, the idea that they're, I mean, the founders of KIPP also are, you know, are Teach for America alumni. I think they've got a good thing going that is bringing talented people in. And when you look at that, that is the harshest way to look at their model, is to look in the classroom at the students of the teachers who are not concentrated in any way. That's ignoring a lot of the benefits of the model. And another benefit it's ignoring, too, is that I think it's important in education. This is one of the points I've been sort of not making as well as I could. One of the things I've really changed my mind on in this cause is expectations. I'm not sure how reasonable it is to expect us to be able to raise an arbitrary kid's test scores. There is such a strong component of ability in there. There is such an issue where they're entering with this difference, and that may have to be addressed earlier if it can be addressed. And so, you know, I also think, but it's also worth considering that having better teachers, having a better experience in school, it could have effects on who you are. And you know, we don't have a lot of documentation of that, but I think the achievement score, like, that has got to be the toughest.
Right. I appreciate that it's challenging for the achievement score to be met. Anyway, it in some ways just a combination of the question about scalability with the, like, relatively.
Well, their core has grown a lot recently, and it's scheduled to grow an enormous amount. That's what we know. We don't know that every X dollars means another trained teacher. So it's a concern, but it's a national organization.
I'll stop.
Do the teachers get paid by the district? Do they get paid?
What's that?
How do the teachers get paid in Teach for America?
They do not get paid by Teach for America. They get paid by the public system. Teach for America is spending that money to train them, essentially, and, you know, train them, screen them, operate an organization that deals with the state and places the teachers. The teachers are paid by the state, though.
Yeah, so my arbitrary sense is that they hurt the world, but I don't know. It's close. Okay.
Anyway, we don't necessarily have to go down this road. I'm not, like...
Yeah, I don't feel strongly about it either.
I don't feel strongly about it, but anyway, it's something that stuck out in
my mind.
Look,
I think for a donor who's determined to... again, like I said, I keep questioning... My commitment to this cause of K-12 education has fallen, but there's a lot of people who...
you know, you're not going to talk them into what I'm saying. They want, they are convinced that they want to improve education, and I think for someone who's determined to do that, I think Teach for America, it's like a, it's a safe bet, something that I'm confident is doing some good, at least for that goal, and so I'd put it on the list of recommended.
Assuming Tim or Virginia, do you guys, are you guys comfortable with keeping it? If you are, then we'll just move on.
Teach for America?
We're just talking about whether they're going on our list of recommended organizations.
Right.
We voted to give the grant to KIPP.
Yeah. I was happy to give it to KIPP. What was the size of the grant that you'd be looking at for Teach for America?
None. We just, this is just whether or not it would be, basically we have a granting organization, then we have like our other, you know, donors. These are other good organizations that you should think about donating.
And that stuff does, I believe it matters, at least if we, if we're continually able to get interested, engaged traffic, because when we looked at our stats for December, I mean, you know, Partners in Health, they got, I don't know, they got quite a few donations. And I think everyone who was recommended by us got at least one donation from, and in many cases, you know, up to 10, even if they weren't the winner, got donations from, you know, people using our website.
I'm more comfortable with Teach for America than for the Children's Scholarship Fund. So yes, Teach for America, I'm happy to have that up.
Yeah, well, I think, like, I'm getting a little stronger in this as I think about it. But so Holman, your reasoning on saying it's worthwhile, you're considering, okay, so you got the $15,000 to $20,000 per teacher place money that, like, wouldn't it be better to go directly? And then the and the lost, like, whatever, those hours to get that from those people, to get that impact, like, that whole model, like, that's a pretty damn expensive model to get that impact.
I think, well, there's two things I feel. One is that I'm happy to put something like, well, on our list of recommended organizations, I'm happy to put something like, if this goal of education is really important to you, we think this organization is someone that you can feel is making a difference in that cause, but there are also questions about whether, you know, whether that is having costs in terms of just human capital in general. I'm happy to put something like that, but I would like it to be out there for donors who are looking to see what we think about education. And the other thing is that I think it's a little, I don't feel good at all about granting KIPP and then saying Teach for America is bad. That's something we'd have to resolve if we really.
Well, it's not bad.
No, we just, it's just a question.
No, it's a question of recommending it, not saying it's bad.
Yeah. And certainly we would publish all the, I mean, as we do with all the people who we review, we would publish all the information for any donor to read.
Sure. Just keep in mind, I mean, do you see what I'm saying? That if we're granting KIPP, like KIPP has really got a debt to Teach for America, and they acknowledge that. And so it's a little odd in my mind to, you know, to be not recommending one of the organizations that really is doing something that they are relying on and is a really important thing that works for them. And then to recommend KIPP.
And so it works for them.
A little odd. It's not that crazy. I mean, you could say that if KIPP, you know, if KIPP got a lot of money and then they could run, I think they are looking into running their own teacher training program. So
and is it because they, like, what is it that gets them to get teachers that way? It's because they don't have their own teacher training program, or is it because they think the teachers are better, or they think the teachers are cheaper?
It's not.
Like, why do they rely,
I don't think,
so heavily?
It's an expense thing. I think they are looking for the best teachers they can find, and they tell us that most of those teachers are from that program.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's
right, because it funnels highly capable people.
I mean, I can see Greg's argument. Greg could be saying basically, I don't want to pull more talent into this area, but I do want to take the talent that's there and concentrate it. And that would be an argument for granting KIPP and not recommending Teach for America.
Right.
I can certainly see that. I don't know. I think this is. I don't know, maybe we should just vote on this, on whether to recommend them. We're going to write them up. We're going to say everything we know about them. We're going to acknowledge the good and the bad. Do they go on our list of recommended charities? I think it's reasonable to just vote on that and move on.
So basically the only person who hasn't spoken, I think, is Tim. Tim, can you just offer up your thoughts on this, and then we can have a decision?
Bob, before you brought some of these things up, I would have been leaning towards Teach for America in general. I think these are all quite salient points about concerns about Teach for America and whether it's worth recommending to the individual donor. I mean, Greg, I'm not quite sure where you're falling. I would be comfortable voting with Bob and Greg based on their thinking in this direction, that we wouldn't want to recommend them based on these points that have been brought up.
Yeah, I mean, I lean that way, but I want to get whole Manelli's comfort.
It's a very hard thing
with that.
It's hard for me because it's like I kind of have to decide. Part of the decision is like, are we, you know, it's how we treat causes, because I think that we've been doing a lot more thinking lately about how the causes compare to each other, and we want to do this thing going forward of doing broader causes. But kind of in the old model or in the, you know, the way our website is set up, I kind of, you know what I mean? It's like if you're kind of like, well, you're in this cause, you're in education, I'm not going to win that argument with you. You want to do something for education, then I'd say, hey, if that's what you want, this is someone who's going to provide that to you, and we are operating on the model of sort of, you know, we're not trying to, we are trying to help people make informed decisions about what charity to give to, and we rank charities because that makes us ask all the questions we need to ask. But our goal is to, you know, is to give people their options based on what they want. And so I guess I would lean toward recommending them, even though I'm not sure that I would personally donate to them, because I think that's something that someone can decide. And I think it's, you know, when you come to the Cause 4 store at GiveWell, I think it should be in the aisle.
Right, but the question, it is going to be in the aisle either way, right? This is a question whether we stamp,
well, not,
stamp
it
with the
it
approval.
Isn't. I mean, the way our page is laid out, what recommended means is that when you go to our overview page, it lists our recommended charities, and there's a donate button for each one. And then on the side, there's a list of all our charities, but it's a difference. I mean, you know, you came to the GiveWell store looking for an education helping thing to buy. You know, this is what you see in the front of the store. I think it matters. So, my inclination would be to, yeah, put them on the list. They're doing what they're trying to do. They're proving it. They're running as they should run, you know, and then there's the question of what the goal is. I'd put them there, and then I'd put in the blurb that we have this concern.
I'm comfortable with that approach.
I am also. I'll vote for that.
Yes, count me in.
That's fine.
Okay. So those are the grants. So I think for the rest of the meeting, I mean, all I want to do is that we have been talking about our plans for 2008. Now what I want to do is I want to have a meeting in about a month, and Lucy mentioned this, and at that meeting I'm going to have a formal write-up of how things went the first year, what we learned, and what we want to do next.
Wait, hey, hold on. Before you move on, just with there's one issue we have to discuss with the KIPP grant, which is,
oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
The actual charity,
right,
to which,
right, okay,
we cut the check.
Yeah.
So do you want to just go and explain that issue?
I'll explain that. There's the KIPP Foundation is one charity, a 501c3, and there's KIPP New York, which I actually think is technically not a 501c3, but it's a network of 501c3s in New York. This is just something we've run into trouble with, and we've got to be clear about it next year, but when we say things like we're focusing on New York, that gets interpreted different ways. And so we originally sent our invitation to the KIPP Foundation. They saw our focus on New York. They said, we want the New York people to handle this. And then they did. And then we kind of found out about what the different organizations do. And the KIPP Foundation, one that is, it's a national organization. It focuses on recruiting and training principals and working to start up schools. And KIPP New York is, you know, it's the network of schools in New York, and what they use their money for is partly they have to provide 20% of the cost of educating these students, because that's the rule for charter schools. So they're only getting 80% as much funding as the public schools. They provide the other 20%, and then with the remaining, with any more money, they have some of these other programs that are basically trying, it's the same idea of consolidation. You know, take each kid and try to get them as good an education as possible all the way through. So it's things like providing money for summer programs, or, you know, or for, actually I think they might even be looking into doing some assistance for, you know, helping get into college, helping to attend maybe private high schools, because they don't want these kids going from a bad situation to kid for 4 years then to a bad situation. So there's kind of there's those two organizations, and both of them told us that it doesn't matter too much because I think one of the founders of KIPP works at KIPP New York, and that basically that they all, you know, the KIPP is a very good representative of KIPP, the organization, and that they do a lot of the more experimental stuff would be done there anyway, and that either side would be happy with us giving it to the other. And so kind of where I lead, like kind of what I want to do, I think KIPP Foundation is more, like if you're a donor and you just want to help people and you don't have a particular preference, I think I'd probably go with the KIPP Foundation, like very, very slightly, but I don't think it matters much. And KIPP New York is the one who applied. They did all the work. And out of fairness, I think it's not a problem to give the grant to KIPP New York. That's what I would want to do. So we'll explain both options on the page when we say where to donate, but we have to be clear on where that grant's going, and I would want to give it to the organization that we dealt with, KIPP New York.
Given that that was how we named the cause, I think that makes sense. I think it would be somewhat in contravention of what we said and what we said to the donors to give it to the KIPP Network rather than KIPP New York.
I think that KIPP New York makes sense to me, too.
Okay.
Fine with me.
Yep. I mean, to be clear, that geographical focus has been a big point of confusion because we always meant it as kind of like, you know, we're gonna use this to narrow the field, but our goal is just to get a good organization. So when we grant Nurse Family Partnership, we're not granting their New York office. We're granting their national office who we dealt with. But I think in this case, since we dealt with KIPP New York, they're the ones who did our app, and because it seems like they're a good organization and a good representative of KIPP, then I think so.
Okay.
So, and wouldn't they, like, it would also seem like they're dealing with that internally, like they're funding from the foundation, the ones that, like, they would probably just fund New York less if New York has more money.
To a certain extent, I would think so.
But that's a detail. So the other thing that I thought, was it this charity that we have somebody who donated a specific?
Was it three?
Don't we have a specific donor who picked one of these charities?
No, we have people who allocated their money and said, I want this going to K-12 education. I think we only have $10,000 that are marked that way.
Okay. Is that right? Okay. So anyway, that's fine. So back to my other point with the, so given Tim's point is just an additional reason why you're near, like, it's just easier if we do the New York City thing anyway, because the confusion is gone. I would have been confused by the same thing Tim is, and I can't imagine, you know, people closer than us that. So.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's the cost of, you know, any difference between the two. It's not, it's balanced out by the fact that this is more fair, less confusing, more consistent with what we said.
Right. Done.
But to be, want everyone to be fine with the fact that, you know, PSI is an Opportunity International. Those are international organizations. They're not Africa organizations. And when we grant our family partnership, we're sending it to the national NFP office.
Right, and that we're going to recommend the national KIPP people, right? Primarily?
Well, we're going to put both options on there, I think.
Okay, good.
Okay, so, all right, this phone is beeping me like crazy. Let me just call back in on the cell phone, okay?
Okay.
All right, I'll be right back.
Bob, just while we're waiting for Holden, I would suggest that after Holden sort of goes through the recommendations, that we move to a board-only, just brief discussion.
Yep, I think that's a good idea, Tim.
Okay.
I'm back.
Hi.
Everyone here?
Yep.
Okay. So now all I want to do, so like I said, we're going to have another meeting about the 2008 plan, but I just wanted to, I kind of wrote up a very rough version of it, and there's those highlights And I would just like to see if people have any questions about those, because in my mind, as we write up this thing, we're going to be writing, you know, kind of a more detailed, more specific, more supportive version of that file. And so if there's objections to it, it seems like better to get them out now.
I think I just had a couple of questions, Holden.
Yep.
Just in the fact that you're saying you're proposing to focus on getting formal commitments rather than re-granting money,
yep.
How do you actually track that?
That is an open question. That's one of the things that we're going to be dealing with when putting together the new plan. My thought, and this is uninformed, like the next step for me in this plan is to talk to a lawyer about exactly that question, is, you know, how can we do this? But my thought is that it should be possible that we can either partner with a donor-advised fund or we can become a donor-advised fund. And a donor-advised fund is the sort of thing like, you know, like your Fidelity, you can give stock to Fidelity and then tell Fidelity to send us a donation, for example. And so they're certainly structured that, you know, that they take recommendations. They take the donation and they literally hold it there. And then they take recommendations from the donors and they grant it. And so it seems to me like it's pretty clear that we could set things up that way.
Okay.
That we could take recommendations from the donors and those, you know, most donor-advised funds, they do exactly what the donor says as long as it's 501c3, and whatever account we use would not operate that way. It would require, you know, it would only take a recommendation for a charity that met our criteria.
Okay, because then, I mean, my next question follows on from that, and that is the actual funding of GiveWell from an operational perspective.
Yep.
And how that money is being divided up if you've got new donors that are coming on and giving passing through 100% of their donations to recommended charities,
yep.
But somehow GiveWell or the functioning of GiveWell is being supported by, let's say, key donors for want of or foundation donors for want of a better reason. And are people going to be happy with that? But I guess it's a fairly broad-based discussion.
I agree that's a concern. And I think the original vision for GiveWell was just, you know, people will give to us, they'll feel good about it, we'll make the decision of how much to put into overhead and no one will mind because, et cetera. You know, when we talk to people, we just get the same message over and over, which is I don't believe that most donors think that way. I think that to most donors, you know, having the choice is important and having that understanding of what their money is doing and what it isn't is important. And the reason that we're doing things this way is that I basically believe that everyone we talk to, you know, almost everyone we've talked to seems to fall in one of two camps. They either would like to use our research but aren't particularly attracted to, you know, to any of the, you know, they would like to use our research, but they're concerned about what it costs. So we have, you know, we have one major donor like that right off the top of my head. And also, you know, they don't see our making the decision as a positive. They'd rather make the decision. And then there's the other kind of donor that doesn't care about our research for them, that they don't want to give to our recommended charities because they're a big donor or an institutional donor. And so, you know, they're not really looking for help. They're looking for us to help others. And they're interested in the GiveWell mission, and they're interested in supporting GiveWell. So, you know, just about any foundation grant we got, for example, would fall in that category, but there's also just a lot of highly wealthy individuals who take that same attitude towards their giving. Like, look, I don't need your help to decide where I'm giving, but I like your project, and I want to support your project. And so the basic idea behind this plan is that, you know, we're trying to fit our product to the market, and if it doesn't work, we'll do something else, but that's our best guess as to what will work and serve the most donors the best. And I think it'll work well, because the idea is that by getting formal commitments to donate, we won't be in the dark about our money moves. We'll know, and we can use that information to decide how much administrative expense is appropriate, and then raise that expense from other donors for whom we'll have a strong case. So the way I literally picture working is we run around getting the formal commitments to donate, and then, you know, we have X dollars committed to donate. Well, now we can turn around and go to an institutional funder or just any funder and say, look, we're going to move this much money. We have this, you know, we have X million dollars that's going to go to our recommended charities, and we need to do better research to make that happen. Or we need this or that, and so don't you want to fund that and kind of you know, spend your money helping that X dollars get where it needs to get. And I think that's a good thing for both. I think that's something that, you know, it's obviously a good deal for the people who are just donors and not funders of us. You know, it's obvious why that's going to be easier to raise money from them that way. And then with the other people who want to help us out, I think it's going to be good to be able to point, you know, to have as large a number as possible of money committed to our charities and use that as the argument, or, you know, the key piece in the argument for why they should be funding us directly. There's disadvantages to this approach, for sure. There's people who would just like to give to us for a certain cause and forget about it from there. We certainly have some donors in that mentality. And ultimately, long term, if we were really moving a lot of money, it would be better to have discretion over it ourselves because we would be able to do things that individual donors can't. We would be able to, you know, fund things that are less scalable, and we'd be able to fund evaluations. But I think that for where we are in our development, I think we want, you know, the biggest question on GiveWell is how much money can we move? And we want to take away every unnecessary obstacle to moving a lot of money. And then if we answer that question and we're doing well, we can, you know, we can think about changing our structure and our offerings again. I think at this point in our development, what we need to do is we need to, we need to move as much money as we can and demonstrate the need for this project and know how demanded it is and whether it's wanted and whether it's worth it. And this is the best way to pursue that. Hello?
We're here.
Well, I can't hear anything.
Yep,
we're here, Alden. Nope, there's nobody saying anything. Yeah, I'm okay with what you said. Like, I mean, I get the reality of that. I think that that's the reality. You're still going to have to fund the operation. So anyway, I don't know if we don't need to talk about the details now. I think that's sensible what you're saying.
Well, as far as funding the operation, like, this is our plan for 08, right? Not forever. We did something different for 07. So I think this is a perfect plan for 08 because we already, if nobody retracts on their pledge or donation, you know, our operations at their current size are covered through 08. And so if we were to then raise a lot of money, we could then think about, okay, now we need to do more research and we'd be able to adjust to that as it happens. But at this point, that's not going to leave us in the red. The one issue with that is that things will change if we decide to hire a director of development who's, you know, likely going to command a high salary, higher than minor Ellie. And that's an issue, but I also think we're going to meet more people who, and we have met more people, who are potentially interested in funding our operation. And so I don't think we're done raising money for that. I don't think we need much more to hire a director of development. And I think it's just worth mentioning that, you know, that director of development thing, we can have that conversation now or we can have it later, but I think that's going to be particularly, like, funding that position, one specific foundation. I think that's the best way we can, like, the best thing we can offer them is the chance to fund that person. So that's kind of what's going through my head is, okay, we're funded to do our thing, to do our operations, so let's just move as much money as we can. And let's try and get the development director funded by that foundation. And if not, you know, we don't need to raise much more. And then if the, you know, if the fundraising is doing really well and we need to scale up, then we'll address it then.
Well, I don't understand in the recommendation the causes issue when you talk about doing causes in sequence, meaning that that there is a limited number of causes. You do all the research on one cause and then that sits there for 12 months, forever, until the cause gets renewed again, and then you move on to another cause?
Yeah. Well,
under that scenario, how many causes in 2008?
Well, in my mind, I think we should, well, they're broad causes, so I think we should do one at a time unless there's enough demand that we staff up and do more. I think that doing more than one at once is frustrating for our applicants because there are these long stretches where they hear nothing and then we need something quickly. And it's bad for us. Like, it's good for us to be able to really get deep into a cause and just, you know, do
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I mean, I understand the argument about doing it one at a time, but that's not the question I asked. The question I asked is how many causes get done in a year?
Ah, I, That's a hard thing for me to answer. I don't know. But I don't think that, I certainly don't think the answer depends on whether we do them sequentially or all at once. I think we have to be reasonable about doing causes well and not doing them too well. And I actually think we did a decent job with that for 07. We weren't perfect. We didn't hit our deadline that we thought we were going to hit, but ultimately, you know, we didn't take forever. We took, you know, several months, and I think that we've made a good crack. We've looked at all the information that's publicly easily available, and we didn't try to get it perfect, but we did a lot. So, you know, we're going to have to do that. That's going to have to be, and it's really hard to know how long, it's just really hard to estimate how long cause is going to take. Like, all I can really do is do things like, you know, look at, I will do that for the next meeting. I will look at, this is how many causes we did in 07, this is how long it took us, this is how many staff we had working this many hours. So then if you take, like, cause bits per hour, then you can project how many we can do in 08, and I could answer that question. But I don't think the answer depends on whether we do them one at a time.
And what you're suggesting here, Holden, is to do, because of the scope aspect of it, just so I'm trying to get a rough sense in my mind about what this would mean for how much we'd get done, from a scope perspective, it would be a lot bigger than just the causes that we're doing right now. Is that right? The causes that we have done so far?
Yeah, I mean, you got to, like, the developing world aid cause would be, like, the equivalent of, like, four of our causes now anyway, sort of, except that we would do it in a more top-down way. We wouldn't have to be, you know, segmenting it and determined to get to the bottom of each one. We'd be seeing what are the different things you can do well that have a good organization behind them,
right,
and not bothering with things where we can't, you know, where we can't find anything.
Four times.
It was, you know,
four times bigger gives us a sense. That's fine.
Again?
Just saying roughly four times bigger gives...
Well, I'm just thinking literally. We did saving lives. We did fighting poverty. But other things, there's like general health, which is kind of related to saving lives. It's like half the cause, which is just, you know, getting broader than saving lives and talking about malnutrition and debilitating diseases. And then there's, you know, in the developing world, the two other causes that I see a lot of mention of are education and abandoned children. So that's four and a half causes. And that, you know, and those would all be included in that developing world aid cause.
Okay.
But, I mean, it's a different situation because if we, you know, if we're not finding anyone who can clearly explain what they're doing for abandoned children, it's not like we have to solve the abandoned children cause. We're just looking for a bunch of good options in developing world aid.
Does anyone have any other questions about this rough draft plan?
I just had a few, and it goes back to the causes. Holden just saying, this is on the first page in highlights, dot point four, focusing on fewer and broader causes, but you've also got research that focuses on identifying good times, places, and ways. To me, that's just so broad-brushed. How you quantify that or come up with anything? I was just interested in having more explanation around that.
That is a very, very broad idea, and it's not, I don't think it's a major point for now because it's something that we're going to see how demand is, and it's probably not the first thing we're going to do. But I can give you a couple specific examples of exactly what that means. For example, one guy had an idea for us that I thought was a really good idea, to take all the diseases that people are researching how to cure, and for each disease say, this is what it does to you, this is how many people it affects. If we were to cure this disease, this is what you would expect. It would be this many people who, you know, were better off in such and such a way. And then this is how much money has been spent on this cause every year since X. And just put that information out there and not try to find the best organization at curing cancer. But I think there'd be an enormous amount of value in that because I think as we think more about GiveWell, you know, we are not serving everyone. We're serving a particular set of people, and the people who sit best with us, I believe, are very kind of broad-minded humanitarians who are as interested in the question of what cause to donate to as they are in the question of how to best get the bang for their buck in their cause. So I think there'd be a lot of, like, I would really like to know the answer to that if I were thinking of donating to disease research, and it's something I, you know, really want to know. And so another idea in the same vein, this is actually, both these ideas came from other people. There was a guy who said we should go to every developing region in the world and just say how much money has been spent there every year in aid and what's happened to their infant mortality from various causes and their, you know, their adult mortality from tuberculosis and their poverty rates and et cetera. And that's it. And that's a lot of work, and that's something very useful, and that's something very different from what we've been doing.
I would just want to go on the record here as saying I believe both of those to be actually completely worthless.
Okay.
I would agree. Yeah.
There are lots of academics who look at sort of that stuff, but that's not the problem that confronts the vast majority of donors. It's not to know broad information like that. It's to, so who do I give my money to?
Yeah, exactly.
And at, okay. at those broad levels, it comes down to, well, it's irrelevant how the infant mortality change in Africa based on total aid to Africa, because it doesn't take into account, well, how much of that aid was actually directed in meaningful ways at infant mortality, and how much got spent hiring consultants from the United States to wring their hands about how bad the infant mortality problem
was. Look, I agree with your objections to it. I think that it, like, there's problems with it. There's also advantages of it. You know, we're doing these causes, and it's, you know, you have to get so thorough to do things at the level we're doing them. And, you know, I'm just thinking as a donor what I would want to know as a broad-minded humanitarian donor and what I do want to know and, you know, about how to, but I'm just thinking purely about how can we allocate our money as well as possible. I think there's something to be said for just, you know, trying to do a heuristic broad overview of what all your options are. And, you know, and before, you know, just doing, you could think of it as just doing more research, you know, what causes we should be researching next, except that donors could use it because they could say, you know, well, maybe this organization isn't perfect, but this is their model, this is what they do, this is where they work. So I don't know. I think it's, like, the broad goal in my mind is to help people donate, and I think it would do that, and it would create better information. It's just a different form, it's a different kind. There's some things it's not accomplishing and things it are, but things it is.
Well, let me ask a clarifying question there, Holden, because there's two different ways to interpret that. One is that we do that too, and the other is that we do that instead.
Yeah, I know where you're coming from, and this is one of the things that's kind of hazy that we have to get specific on. I mean, that was sort of like, this is an idea that we think it's worth noting, worth getting any thoughts people have, and we are getting those thoughts. My inclination would probably be that we would do that also, if at all. You know what I'm saying? That we wouldn't, I don't really see how we'd get donors to line up for that as like an exclusive thing. But maybe we can get an institutional grant to hire a couple people to work on that. Or, you know, if we just did fundraising went well and we were able to do that in addition to other stuff, we could do it.
Yeah, I mean, I perceive that very differently, thinking about it as how does GiveWell decide which causes it's going to look at and then publishing that information versus, because, you know, the information that's being talked about, when I say that it's worth less in the absence of any information about then ultimately who do I give my money to.
Well, I think we would, just to be clear, I mean, we would get the first layer of, we would say these are the organizations working in this cause, and then maybe we would do just one phone call with each of them and say, how are you different from the other ones, and publish those answers, you know? It's just, very different. It's, like, it's very obvious what all the problems with this are and why the approach we've been taking, like, what it has over that, but there's pros and cons, and just on the broad goal of putting donors in a much more informed place than they were, I think it's got something to say.
I don't find that to be all that different from GuideStar and many other organizations that just provide directories of who's doing what.
I think it would be different, so maybe we should table this for now.
Are there any other questions about this draft?
Well, I think it's just important to get, you know, the development director to me is the biggest sort of thing that it's like that should be in like bold red, because we haven't finalized that yet in any way, and I think we're not going to finalize that decision at this meeting, but I mean, it's something that we haven't talked about before. It would be a major expense. The more I think about it, the more I think it's a good idea, because it's a major thing that's going to make GiveWell succeed or fail, and almost every skill you need for it is a skill, you know, that skill that come in a package that we should be able to find, and not necessarily skills that the current staff has. And so it just, you know, as opposed to our first year, everything we were doing was something that kind of, you know, there's not a discipline for it. There's not a I wouldn't know what to look for on a resume for it. This is something very different. It's something very important, and it's something where I do feel that we can identify a person and hire a person who will do it better than the current staff can. And it's also a, you know, potential. It's just a way of starting to work on the leadership question as well. I mean, then we've got, you know, we've got a person who could take on more of those duties and just complement my weaknesses. So,
right. I think
it's a big thing, but I wanted to raise it.
Right. And it seems like in that idea, you call it money moved, whatever, the ratio of the amount of money we're spending on overhead relative to the amount of money that's going to great charities, it seems like a very highly leveraged way to help improve that ratio.
Like, either it is highly leveraged or it doesn't work and we shut down GiveWell. That's kind of my feeling, right? It's like, this is what we need to do.
Right.
This is the best way to do it. And if it doesn't work, then, you know, that to me is the question about GiveWell. I mean, we did the first kind of year, we answered a lot of questions about, you know, what there is out there and what kind of value can be added, and the answers aren't definitive, but to me, the big question about GiveWell is, do enough people want it? And so we should just address that question the best way we can.
Okay, so I'm a little bit confused on what we're doing now. Should we be prepping us because we're going to discuss this at the next meeting? Like, I'm pretty much just
prepping you, and I'm telling you that we're going to write up a proposal to do this. So, you know, if there's objections to this, you know, in concept at this early stage, I just want them now. And other than that, we don't have to discuss it more.
Yeah, I mean, there is a discussion board only now to follow this is what I would say is the next thing. And out of that would come guidance back to Holden and Ellie on what to do next with this.
I don't see why.
Well, I think that's fine, Tim.
Yeah, I thought, Tim, when you had suggested that it was for some basically reasons why the board would meet X employees for discussion about the plan, I think it's... Anyway, I think it's fine to have people here with us, to have staff with us talking about it.
Yeah, I think we should be with you, and I'm interested in hearing why not, if there's a reason why not.
I mean, because there are further conversations about GiveWell in general, now that we're talking about the long-term strategy of GiveWell. That's ultimately something set by the board, and those conversations should happen with people who are on the board involved in them, and, you know, I would say it's similar to other meetings we've had with just the board, is if we are going to be setting long-term strategy for the organization, then that's a conversation for the board and not for non-members.
Tim, I totally agree. Totally agree with you.
Yeah, I do strongly disagree. Like, the decision needs to be made by the board, but basically the people who are going to be involved in running this organization and executing the vision, right, should be involved in creating the vision. Right? It's like whatever Holden says is not what goes. It's whatever the board says is what goes.
To me,
yeah, but why you wouldn't want my input in there is totally unclear. I mean, my understanding is that staff should be excluded from reviews of staff performance. That makes sense to me. But this, you know, an evaluation of GiveWell as a project, and whether GiveWell should exist and how GiveWell should exist, that is not a review of staff performance. That's not deciding whether to give Holden a raise or a demotion or fire him. That's, you know, that's about a topic on which I feel that I, you know, my perspective is vital.
Right. So is that the topic, Tim? What is the topic? Like, and I guess you could just say you just want to talk about this at the board with just the board. But I'm just trying to understand, because when you had said that before, I was assuming that the topic was related to basically a follow-up on the stuff we had discussed at the last board-only part, essentially a continuation of the review of Holden and thinking about where we are there. Or is the topic, like, I also agree with Bob, if the topic is to talk about these highlights and the direction, I would also really want Holden and Ellie's insights into that as well. I would feel unprepared to discuss that without them. But if the topic is, okay, let's make sure we've wrapped up the issues from the other meetings and that we're progressing on this, more like what I would consider the review of Holden and Ellie and their conduct, then that I understand. So I'm not sure which topic you were talking about.
Yeah, I don't mean for us to go into a detailed discussion of this draft. Of the plan. It is more a continuation of our earlier conversations, but you know, it relates to this plan because it relates to the the overall governance issues and what sits above this plan for 2008, which is where GiveWell as an organization is going and the governance of that, and are we progressing along the things that we were talking about and what the next steps are.
I mean, I just want to put it out there. I think I should be a part of conversations about governance, too, unless those conversations are what to do with me. I think that is, like, generally the rule, that is in the our bylaws, and that is in the, the recommended best practices, and I agree with it, that I should be excluded from things that have to do with my performance and whether my responsibilities and pay and whatever are going to be raised or lowered. But anything other than that, I mean, if we're talking about...
It comes down to just the basic principles of governance, Holden. Right now, you are not the executive director of the organization. You are a program officer of the organization. And so it is not clear under the current structure that we put in place in the organization that the individual program officers, while certainly having some input, necessarily need to be involved in conversations about governance and strategy of the organization as a whole.
Well, I think we should be...
No one's saying need to be. We're just saying it makes the most sense since we, know the most about it. We are doing it all the time. It just seems illogical.
I'm not suggesting that we're making any decisions during this conversation and that we're going to exclude you and not consult you on any of these sorts of things. But the way governance...
Hey, if you're not going to make it that's different. Because anytime you want to have a talk with someone and you don't want to be around, then that's fine. But I do, I just want to put it out there that, it does make me feel better if you're not going to make decisions there and just hand them to us. That certainly makes me feel better. And I also just want to make the general point that, although this isn't about me being executive director or program officer, the fact is that Ellie and I are the founders and the people who work on this all day. And so that's just, if there was someone else who I just thought knew GiveWell really well, I'd want them in there too. The people who know GiveWell really well are the people who I want in the meeting. And we are those guys.
Right, but they're definitely board decisions. So, first off, if it was up to me, I would have you in the conversations. But I do agree, essentially in concept, that there are these lingering issues of what are we going to do? We left you, we demoted you. We made that decision. We talked about last time. We're going to revisit where we are on those things. And I think that is a sensible conversation that we have to have, which I think is most of what Tim's talking about, and that weighing everything. While I don't care whether you're there or not for that conversation, certainly wouldn't affect my views on it or affect my ability to talk about it. I think it makes sense that it would have others, and generally the good governance would suggest that we should have that conversation without you, and that would be the main topic is resolving the issues that were updating the issues on that we had in terms of your review last time, right?
Well, yeah, relating to my performance, and as I said, discussion of my performance should, or at least that's the kind of thing where I'd say, yeah, exclude me. I agree with you on that.
Okay, so unless people have questions for Holden, Nally, and Teal about the highlights, or unless Holden, you have anything additional to add before we sort of wrap up with you guys, and then we can kick you guys off and go to...
Like to propose that, actually, that you just guys do this another time for two reasons. Really, for one reason. Lucy's not here. And she has, she's a big part of this and pretty opinionated on this. And, we did enough votes to do the grant. But, I think you should try and do this with Lucy. And also, I don't know, personally, I'd also like to just finish conversations that I never finished with Greg, so I'd prefer to use his time now that way. That's obviously up to him and you guys.
I agree with the Lucy part of that. I'm also happy to have a conversation with you all about anything you want, but I wouldn't feel comfortable having, so I'll listen to whatever Tim has to say, but I wouldn't be comfortable making board decisions without Lucy's guidance, personally.
Oh, I totally agree with that, but I don't think there's any reason why the board can't have a discussion with Lucy not being here.
Certainly an update on the things.
It's just a question of whether this is the time you want to do that, because you're probably going to have to have a discussion again anyway. That's up to you. You just tell me what you want to do.
Well, so Tim, what do you think about rescheduling a board meeting when we can get Lucy?
I think that's absolutely critical in terms of actually making decisions. I mean, I just love it if we could take 10 minutes right now.
So then holding, can I talk to you in 10 minutes?
Yeah. I'm just calling my idea of my cell phone number.
Can you just send it to my email?
Yep.
Okay.
All right.
Take care, guys. Thanks.
Bye.